This is Midday Magazine for Friday, July 31st. I'm Angela Denning. The National Transportation Safety Board released a preliminary report on the July 17th airplane crash that occurred 18 miles west of Juneau. Wings of Alaska Flight 202 crashed into a mountain about 15 minutes after departing Juneau on its way to Hoonah, killing the pilot, Fariah Peterson. However, all four passengers survived. Chris Shaver is the NTSB investigator in charge, and he says there were no reported problems at takeoff.
And the only communications that the pilot had with air traffic control, which would have been at takeoff, she didn't relay any issues.
The plane is certified to fly under visual flight rules, which means it has to stay out of the clouds and maintain a visual reference with the ground for navigation. Shaver says weather conditions at the Juneau and Hoonah airports at the time fit visual flight rules. To determine what conditions were like in between, he says he's pulled images from 7 weather cameras. Shaver says the plane's electronic system had a feature that gives visual and audio warnings if the aircraft is approaching terrain. The plane hit a large spruce tree at an elevation of about 1,300 feet above sea level, splitting in two.
Where the separation happened probably played some factor in the survivability of the passengers.
The engine is being sent to Anchorage for further inspection, and the plane's visual display units are being sent to NTSB headquarters in Washington, D.C. A chip inside the display units will hopefully offer flight data, like airspeed and altitude.
We hope that we'll get data all the way up until, 1 to 2 seconds before the accident. It's not going to answer the question of why did something happen, but it's going to give us a much clearer picture of what exactly happened, at least with the flight path of the airplane. So it's another piece of the puzzle.
Shaver says the final report determining probable cause of the Wings of Alaska crash won't come out for another 12 to 18 months. Road construction along two main streets in Petersburg will continue until the end of the summer. The borough expects that all the work will not only improve the roads, but will make the town's sewer system more reliable. The sound of heavy machinery and the sight of bright orange flaggers directing traffic has been the norm in Petersburg for most of the summer. And residents might want to get used to it, because it's far from over. The $8.3 million project is doing improvement work on two of the city's main streets, Nordic Drive and Haugen Drive. The state of Alaska is paying for most of it through the Department of Transportation. The surface of the roads are being redone, as are the sidewalks, curbs, and gutters alongside them. Meanwhile, the borough is working on the sewer lines that go underneath or nearby the two roads. That's costing roughly $1.3 million of the project. On Nordic Drive, the borough is moving a sewer main line, which was running under South Harbor and buildings along the way. Chris Cotta is the Assistant Public Works Director.
It's exposed in a couple of places. It was installed under the beach.
That was 40 years ago. Since then, the sewer line, which is made of iron, has rusted in spots. So the borough decided to abandon that old pipe and install a new, modern one made of heavy-duty plastic in a new location, underneath Nordic Drive, which is being repaved by the state anyway.
To take care of those issues with where it's exposed and it's corroding, and plus we don't know what a lot of the rest of it looks like. It's under the beach, which is a saltwater environment. If we ever had a problem with it in one of those locations, it would be really hard to deal with. So in addition to the corrosion issues, there's a lot of places where it would be next to impossible to access it.
Meanwhile, on the other road, Haugen Drive, the borough is doing different sewer line work. The goal there is to prevent groundwater from entering the sewer system. Carl Hagerman is the Public Works Director.
Well, overall, the project is going okay. Our portion of the project hasn't been that great, because just about every time that Rockin' Road dug a hole in Haugen to do some work that was in the project, we found something else that was wrong.
What the borough found were manholes in worse shape than expected. Another problem was wrong-sized pipes. They ended up being different than the ones shown on the borough's utility maps once they were unearthed.
It's just been a little bit of a struggle to find things underground that you thought were a certain way, and then you uncover them and they're not.
While it's been a setback, Hagerman says it's maintenance that had to be addressed.
Finding these problems at this time when the road was going to be repaved anyway is an excellent opportunity for the borough to address these problems and not have to incur the additional costs of repaving the road. It would be much more expensive to do that than what we're doing now, taking advantage of the state's project, and they're going to repave the road anyway.
So, the borough tacked on an additional $80,000 to the project to repair the manholes. The timeline for all of the road work looks like this. The state plans to be done with Haugen Drive by the end of August, early September, at least the road itself. They plan to come back next summer and finish paving the bike path. Nordic Drive will take longer. The state plans to continue work there through next summer. The borough will be done with its sewer work long before the state gets done with resurfacing. CECON is the general contractor doing most of the road work, with local company Rockin' Road helping with some of the dirt and digging. That's the sound that people near downtown Petersburg heard yesterday afternoon between 2:30 and 3 o'clock. Petersburg Fisheries Incorporated was blowing a whistle signifying that the fish processing plant had reached 100,000 cases of canned salmon. At 48 cans per case, that's 4.8 million cans of fish. PFI employs hundreds of workers every summer to help process the fish. This week, we are taking a break from the cannery tales, but that will be back next Friday with an exciting music-filled edition of the series. The Wrangell Cooperative Association cut the ribbon on its cultural center and carving shed on Saturday, completing the second phase of the tribe's three-part Native Cultural Revival Plan. The center will serve as a place for recreating 8 sacred totem poles and for teaching Native arts. KSDK's Katerina Sestarek has more from Wrangell.
Dancers started the dedication of the Wrangell Cooperative Association Cultural Center with a performance in front of the new building's gleaming cedar facade. A crowd gathered in the street for the grand opening of what's also known as the carving facility. Wrangell Tribal Council Vice President Richard Oliver said it's a place for local artists, carvers, and entrepreneurs to develop their skills and trade.
Our mission is to foster the spiritual, mental, physical, and social development of our tribe, and it is also to help build a strong, unified, and self-reliant membership.
It's the second part of a three-phase plan to revive the Wrangell tribe's assets. The first part was completed when the Chief Sheikh's tribal house was rebuilt in 2013. The next step for the association is to carve replicas of 8 totem poles that used to stand near the tribal house on Sheikh's Island. The cultural center is where carvers will work on that project.
Shawet Shugu, Kaititla, cedar rope mother, is going to help us bless right now. She is the one that had been holding the culture here in Wrangell for us, and she was holding on with a cedar rope, holding us all together so that we could come here today, so that you could be a witness to this.
That's Virginia Oliver introducing Tlingit Elder Marge Bird. Together, they led a cedar bough ceremony to purify the new building. A long line of tribal members and spectators slowly circled the outside of the building, singing and brushing the walls with fragrant cedar boughs. When everyone circled the building, Bird, Cedar Rope Mother, spoke.
It's like we always hear. We've been here for a long time. We'll always be here, long as you hear our drum. And we're here, and we're going forward. We have our new facility. We have our new Sheikh's house and some other things going on ahead to keep our culture alive for our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren.
Sea Alaska board member Richard Reinhardt Jr., who's from Wrangell, said he wanted to convey the regional Native corporation's appreciation for the cultural revival that's taken place in the local Native community.
It's obvious, and everybody can see it, where for a number of years things seemed silent. Our old A&B hall had fallen into disrepair, and our totem poles were falling down. Totem poles are still down, but thanks to a number, Rasmussen Foundation and a number of the other contributors, these things are all coming back to life.
The Rasmussen Foundation supports Alaskan nonprofits, and it helped fund construction of the Cultural Center and the Chief Shake's Tribal House. Construction of the carving facility was completed last fall, led by project manager Todd White. It's already housed a major carving project and Native arts classes. Artists also use the building to sell their goods to tourists. Tribal administrator Aaron Angerman said it's been more than 10 years since they started planning the cultural revival.
And it's great to see that we're this far, and knowing that we're going to get carving on these totems very soon. And we made it this far from next to nothing, and really confident that these things are going to pay dividends to our members of this community for decades and decades to come.
After a series of speeches, it was time to cut the big blue ribbon tied across the front doors. Chris Norris of the Rasmussen Foundation held the ribbon down so Marge Bird could cut it, and they welcomed everyone inside. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Katarina Sestari.
Not many people wish to raise a child with a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FASD. Diane Laurie is no different, but when she and her husband adopted three children, all later diagnosed with an FASD, they accepted the hardships and the rewards. Lisa Fu has more from Juno.
When you walk into the Laurie household, kids seem to materialize out of thin air. Here's the mom, Diane Laurie.
We have five of our own and one foster, so six kids right now.
Two are biological, three are adopted, and the foster child is through the State Office of Children's Services.
And they just called us a few minutes ago to see if we would take an eight-year-old boy, but we have no room right now.
They've already converted their garage into a comfortable bedroom. At least a dozen foster children have passed through the house since 2005, staying anywhere from one night to 18 months. The Laurie's first adoption was Elena from Russia in 2004.
And within 2 days, I knew something was wrong.
Elena was 21 months old. Laurie says she was different than the other Russian infants getting adopted.
She would stare at things. She didn't know how to play with toys. She would play with a little piece of lint more than she would a toy.
Years later, the Laurie's adopted biological sisters Kylie and Christiana from Juneau through OCS. They receive a stipend from the state for the two girls and any foster children that pass through. Laurie is a stay-at-home mom, and her husband is a highway engineer. All three adopted kids were diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders at the FASD clinic in Juneau. The clinic requires some kind of evidence that the biological mother drank during pregnancy in order to do the diagnosis. That was hard for Laurie. She cries as she explains how she pleaded with Kylie and Christiana's biological mom.
Go to OCS and write down that you drank, or that you drank before you knew you were pregnant. That is the greatest gift you can give these children. And she did it.
21-year-old Emily Ann is one of Laurie's biological children. She says the diagnosis opens the door for getting help.
Like, for other people to understand, they're not just bad kids. There's, like, an logical explanation for, like, why they are the way they are, and, like, how to, like, give more ideas on how to, like, actually help them and not just, like, discard them as, like, trash or whatever.
FASD is an umbrella term that's used to describe a range of disabilities, minor to severe. Laurie says each of her three adopted kids falls in different areas. Issues include short attention spans, disorganization, and being overly trusting. One of her kids has a tendency to lie and steal. Elena, who's also been diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder, doesn't communicate her own needs.
She won't voluntarily say, I need something, or I need help, or I'm lost, or something like that. And so one of the things they told us is that she might need long-term care and that she might not be able to live on her own. You know, and that was like, that hurt.
Lori says it's tough to accept that your child has a lifetime disability for which there's no cure. In most cases, you can't tell by looking that someone has FASD.
A lot of times you're out in the community and your kids are doing something stupid, you know, and you're embarrassed. And some people will say really rude things to you, like, you need to control your child. And you're like, wait a minute. I'm doing the best I can. You have no idea. And sometimes I would love to wear a shirt that says, like, my child has FASD, you know, don't judge us.
The Lorries did not set out to adopt three kids with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders.
And there are days when I'm like, oh, I wish I had never adopted, you know? And I think that's with your typical family, too. I think there's days when parents say, I wish I didn't have any kids, you know? I think that's normal.
Lori admits she may say it more than other parents, but there are times when she can't imagine not adopting.
Each little child that you adopt, each little child that you foster, hopefully you're giving them something that will make this world a better place and better understanding and, you know, teach more empathy.
Lori sometimes blames the biological parents, but she knows that's pointless. She says you can't change the past. You can only focus on the here and now and the future. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
It is Friday, July 31st, and that means it is time for the Stocks Report with Dan Berg. He's a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Bellevue, Washington, and he's joining us by telephone. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Angela. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. And how's your week going?
My week is going well. We had kind of a mixed week in the stock market. I was just looking at the chart, the graph of the S&P 500 during the course of this year. And here we are on the last day of July, and it really hasn't gone anywhere this year, and this week is a good case in point. Some companies are doing quite well and are beginning to, you know, earn record profits, and others are having a big problem. And one of the big problems is weak oil. Oil prices are lower again, as I'll get into in a minute. For U.S. economic news, the big news was the Federal Reserve Bank had their meeting, and there was really no news out of that meeting. The statement was almost exactly the same as in their June meeting. However, we had some reasonably good economic news in the country, as we've been having. It showed that gross domestic product in the second quarter was up at a 2.3% annual rate, which is okay, and the labor market still looks strong. So people are assuming that we'll have an interest rate hike either in September or in December, and so we'll see. Over in the EU, there are still negotiations regarding Greece, and so that probably there'll be some announcement perhaps as early as next week. And then in China, as we've been mentioning, they've had a very vicious stock market, bear market in stocks after a big run-up. And the government there has been really heavy-handed. And the latest announcement out of China is that there are ongoing investigations of so-called vicious short sellers. And in this market, you know, naturally, sometimes you buy stocks, sometimes you short stocks. You know, you're free to do what you want to do. But in China, apparently, if you do something that the government doesn't want you to do, you might be prosecuted. So a lot of folks are saying that China is shooting itself in the foot a bit as far as being a welcome. So for the week, the Dow Jones closed at 17,690. That's a 122-point gain. The NASDAQ had a reasonably good week. It closed up to 5,128. That's a 0.7% gain for the week. And the S&P, in spite of oil, closed at 2,103. That was a 1.1% gain for the week. And now probably the biggest news is what's going on in commodities, which are falling across the board, and oil is the most important one. West Texas for next month's delivery is at $46.89. That is the lowest it's been for some time, and that was lower again than last week. And that's beginning to affect the prospects for a lot of different energy companies. Gold also, as one of the commodities, has been hitting lows. Last week it hit a five-year low, and this week it rebounded just slightly to $1,094 an ounce. In the bond market, the 30-year Treasury is at 2.92%, a little bit lower in yield than last week, and the 10-year is at 2.2%.
Well, thanks for that information. It's always interesting just how far oil prices reach and how much of an impact it has on the industry.
Right. Yeah, let me give you some examples of earnings reports this week for individual stocks, and I'll start out with two oil companies. The two biggest ones announced earnings, and Chevron, symbol CVX, was down 4.5% today to $88.48. They missed their earnings projections fairly badly. And ExxonMobil, symbol XOM, the largest U.S. oil company, closed down sharply also more than 4% to $79.21. And there is some speculation beginning that some of the major oil companies may even cut their dividends. For example, the layoffs have become fairly intense. Royal Dutch Shell, which has just started their explorations in the Chukchi Sea up in near Kotzebue, they announced 6,500 layoffs this week, just FYI. Now, for more earnings, Amgen, symbol AMGN, had a very good report that closed at $176.75. That's the largest biotech firm in the country. Facebook announced reasonably good earnings, but the stock didn't do so well. Symbol FB closed to $94.01. That's just the latest example of many of the high flyers in the Internet. For example, LinkedIn also had a stock pullback today of really coming down in value. Pfizer announced earnings, symbol PFE, that closed at $36.06, a pretty good report. Procter & Gamble, symbol PG, that closed down to $76.70. The strong U.S. dollar is hurting their profits from overseas. And then for Northwest stocks, Expedia, which is symbol EXPE, that closed at $121.44, up 12% today. It looks as folks feeling a little bit better about the economy are booking some trips. And then Alaska Airlines, also symbol ALK, looked pretty good this week, closing at $75.75.
Well, thanks so much for recapping what was going on this week. Is there anything that we might want to be thinking about for next week?
Next week?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, next week the most important economic announcement, without question, will be the employment report on Friday. We'll find out what the unemployment rate is and how many jobs are estimated to have been added on Friday. Also, we have a few nationwide surveys of economic activity called the ISM surveys. Those give a real good idea as to the direction of the economy. There's some optimism about those. And, of course, we have lots and lots of earnings reports. We're right in the middle of the season.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. I understand that we won't have a stocks report next week, so it'll be a couple weeks until we talk to you again.
Yeah, I'll be hiking in the North Cascades next Friday.
Sounds like a bummer. No. Well, great. I hope you have a wonderful time, and thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Angela. Have a good weekend.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Dan Berg is a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Bellevue, Washington. He joins us most Fridays for a stocks report.
Listeners are reminded that the information provided is general in nature and may not apply to their personal investment situation. Individuals should consult with their chosen financial professional before making any decisions. Investment products and services are offered through Wells Fargo Advisors, LLC, member of SIPC. Neither Wells Fargo Advisors nor its financial professionals are legal or tax advisors.
And this wraps up KFSK's Midday Magazine. I'm Angela Denning. Thanks for listening.